It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Early Saturday, 26-year-old Aaron Seiler was killed by the Kenosha police in what is Wisconsin's seventh officer-involved shooting so far this year. Police say Aaron armed himself with a weapon when he was confronted by an officer who then shot him.
This comes a week after a Madison police officer killed unarmed black 19-year-old Tony Robinson, sparking protests. In 2014, Wisconsin became the first state in the country to require an independent investigation of all officer-involved shootings, but lawmakers and advocates are still pushing to require further measures in these investigations.
Michael Bell is one of those advocates. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. His son was killed by Kenosha police in 2004. He also went to the scene of Saturday's shooting of Aaron Seiler to see for himself if the new law was being followed. Michael Bell joins us now. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, Rob, Veronica, thank you for having me.
Well, you were on the scene in the aftermath of Wisconsin's seventh officer-related death this year in Kenosha. This was a Saturday. Why did you want to be there?
Well, you know, I've been our family and a lot of others in the state of Wisconsin have been working for external investigation, and that law was implemented in April 2014, and we don't really have any monitors to see that that if the law is being complied with. So it was important for me. This shooting occurred about 2 miles from our house, to go down there and see if the Department of Criminal Justice or who were the investigators that were going to be taking evidence at the scene.
And were there particular things that you were looking for that would clue you in that yes, the new law was being followed to the letter?
Well, I was able to speak directly with the Department of Criminal Investigations investigator. His name was Gil Hernandez. He looked like he was being very overworked. It looked like the stress level was very high. I also did see a special agent down there from a DCI, and also there was a female agent that actually spent some time with the family.
And as we said, this is Wisconsin's seventh officer-involved shooting this year. What do we know so far about this particular case?
Essentially, 26-year-old man had a 4-year-old daughter. I think he was there was a felony warrant out for him, but it was for an administrative type thing. I think he didn't see his probation or parole officer or something like that. There was a violent car accident. It appears that they left on foot. The officer that was on the scene at the time, somehow or another, confronted him in an alleyway, and from what witnesses report, fired probably about 6 shots.
Now, you've been leading the call for officer-involved shootings to be investigated by an outside group, an external group. That idea, as you said, is now law. What is your take on how it's working, especially if we look at the case of these two recent shootings, Tony Robinson's death and now Aaron Seiler in Kenosha?
Well, our original law had 3 parts. Let's make sure that the officer was in a clear frame of mind. Let's have an external investigation, and let's have an independent review of that investigation. We were able to get the second part done, that there would be an external investigation. And what we're trying to do is go back for these other parts. The public needs to be assured that there are checks and balances in place. And if you take a look at the aviation industry, I'm a retired Air Force officer and a pilot. Its success is based upon 6 core elements, and law enforcement aren't doing those 6 core elements, and that's what needs to occur for us to build additional trust with law enforcement.
Your own son was killed in an officer-involved death in 2004, and today there's a huge national spotlight on deaths like his where a police officer is involved, and that wasn't the case when your son was killed. What is going through your mind right now as a father, as an activist, as you watch this national conversation unfolding about officer-involved deaths?
I think my son is up in heaven laughing a little bit because here his dad is 11 years later still working at it, and And I think we've made progress. Remember, this is also good for law enforcement as it is for the community, because it actually brings us closer and it makes things clearer. And maybe it will reduce the number of shootings that occur, because about 25% of the shootings are mistake effect shootings, where somebody misinterpreted a wallet for a gun, or in my son's case, an officer had hooked his gun on a car mirror and assumed that was my son, and those types of things. So if we can reduce those shootings, I'm really going to be happy, because now we're going to have a professional database that monitors these types of things and so forth.
Representative Chris Taylor, who championed this new legislation that has passed, she's calling for more requirements, a review panel of the outside investigation, mandatory blood draws, and some of these other things that were initially in there but didn't make the first round. Why do you think more needs to be added to this law?
Well, you know, it's like a three-legged stool. And right now we only have one leg. You need these other two parts. I mean, the public needs to be sure that if an officer decides to use deadly force, that he was in a clear frame of mind. Shame on them if they're under the influence of steroids or mood-altering drugs or alcohol and something like that. But they also need to know that there was an independent review. In my own son's case, I mean, the DA was very close to the police department. He used their endorsements in his next political campaign. There were four police-involved deaths in a 16-month period. He refused to give any of those families an inquest. And so there needs to be an independent review to determine probable cause. And then once you determine that probable cause, you need to distribute the facts of that case throughout the state so that other officers say, this particular case killed someone, and if I do the exact same thing that officer did, I might do it also. And that's the way we're going to reduce the number of police-involved shootings in the state of Wisconsin.
This law calling for an outside investigation, an external investigation, it's still pretty new, and Wisconsin is the first in the country to have a law like this. Is it too soon to be asking for more?
I don't believe so, because there have been pockets of groups, either counties or cities around the state or around the nation, that have had external investigation, but never mandated on a statewide level. And we always knew that this is an important part. Now, this independent review is just advisory. It's essentially a group of law professionals, just not law enforcement, that would look at the facts of the case and say, you know, you did cover everything, or you forgot to do something. You might want to take a look at it here. And we were even asking for a police academy trainer to be on that board, so that way if seven of the shootings determined that there was something that could be improved upon, that trainer can immediately take it back to the academy and say, hey, let's do this differently. This cost seven lives last year or something like that.
A few weeks ago, you testified as part of the president's task force on 21st century policing in Washington. What are you advocating for nationally?
I'm advocating for the law enforcement to model itself after the successes in the aviation industry. If you take a look at what happened in aviation from 1956 to today, the numbers are astronomically successful. But law enforcement are failing at those core elements that aviation is doing, and we're in a national crisis. And so somebody had to speak up on that behalf, and really a pilot is the right person to do that. If you take a look at statistics, our jobs are far more deadly than that of law enforcement, because everything that we do, there's threats in a mountain, a thunderstorm, a person on the ground, or a person in a cockpit, a bird. Everything's a threat to us, and they happen very fast. And so the things that we do in aviation that makes us successful will also lead to success in law enforcement.
And watching your testimony, you're also advocating for some particular training from an emotional standpoint to help police officers, it sounds like.
Yes, I am, because I recognize as a military officer that there are people that suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And one of the people that were testifying at the task force said that, you know, if you're a military person, you go into combat scenario, you're there for 2 or 3 years. But a law enforcement officer is typically there a lifetime. So they're being exposed to much stress and much trauma, and are they processing it correctly? And there are new techniques out there. And one of the things that I discovered on my own journey was that there was a group out in California, a doctor of family medicine, her name is Laurel Mellon. She developed something called emotions-based training. And I found it to be very successful in helping process the emotions that were related to the death of my son. And I think that would be beneficial to law enforcement also.
The investigation into Tony Robinson's death is likely to be very closely followed by the media. What are you going to be focusing on throughout that process?
Well, first off, I have to tip my hat to Chief Koval, because, number one, immediately Department of Criminal Investigations was brought in. And number two, he did something beyond what was required. That officer was actually brought to a hospital, and his blood was checked to make sure that he was in a clear frame of mind. They haven't released those results yet, but at least they did that. And then I'm going to be looking for what is the outcome. you know, there's going to be a number of things that are going to have to be looked at. My own personal experience, when I look at this, I ask myself, why did the officer rush to break down that door? There was only this young man in the apartment, and if he would have waited just 30 seconds more, backup might have been there, and Tony Robinson might be alive today. So we're going to be focusing on that very unique period of time there and why this officer made a decision to crash through that door and not wait 30 seconds more, because that could be a training issue that would be brought out by independent review.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Anytime.
We've been speaking with Michael Bell, retired Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Air Force, father of Michael E. Bell, who was shot and killed by Kenosha police in 2004.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life and our special series on sports and games. Tucked inside the basement of a neighborhood bar in southwest Milwaukee, you'll find the oldest bowling alley in the country. The Holler House has been welcoming customers for over 100 years and hasn't changed much in that time. Machines, they've never replaced the human pin setters. Bowlers keep score by hand. Maureen McCollum visited the landmark during this Sunday afternoon men's league and learned how Holler House got its name.
A man came in here one day and he said, would you like to get drunk with me? My wife's in California. And I said, sure, what the heck. And then the following week when she came back, she's a little German lady. And the day he brought her in, there was a political convention. Everybody's arguing politics. The jukebox is going. Somebody's playing that beat-up piano, and she didn't know where to look. So the following week, he was taking her out to dinner. And he says, sir, where would you like to go for a couple cocktails before I take you to dinner? She said, take me to that Holler House. My name is Marcy Skoronsky, and I've been here 61 years. My in-laws built this place.
Over.
Oldest sanctioned bowling alley in the nation. Once it's sanctioned, then you like if you bowl a 300, and then it counts, yeah.
These are the original lanes, I believe, yeah. So, you know, 100 years of rolling balls down it, you know. Even the approach, it's kind of gnarly here, you know, but it's great. That's why you like it here, you know.
Get down there.
Yeah, we keep track of score on paper.
Kids nowadays have to get the calculators out. We do it manually.
No computers. It's kind of unplugging. We're all plugged in all the time, so. I'm Brian Larson.
My name's John. John Knacker. I've been bowling here since 1978. It's just nice to get out of the house during the winter. And
what'd you get, John?
For sure.
Spare.
Very
nice.
Get some good exercise.
Is that what's the 12-ounce curl?
Hey, I'm throwing an 18-pound ball.
Sunday fun day. Love Sunday.
I bowled till I was about 72, because I'm 89 now. The way I throw my ball, it was so slow that the pin boy just about fell asleep before it hit. That's it. Let me just go.
I think I'm faster than a machine, personally. Carmelo Silva, and what I usually do here is set pins. People bowl here, and I've been working here since 8th grade, 4 years now. It's unique. It's a unique job, and that's what I like about it as well. A lot of people ask me to take pictures with them to sign their score sheets, and I'm just a pin boy. I didn't know I would be taking pictures or signing stuff.
It's comforting knowing that there's some things that don't change, you know, that, I mean, we all like change, but there's some things, there's comfort in knowing that something's always going to be there, or you hope it does. You know. My name's Matthew Oak. Still in my third year, actually. I guess I say only because a lot of these guys, you know, it's like decades long.
We got nice people that come here. Some friends of ours that have been coming in here 50, 60 years. And then the old pin boys, when they go into their careers and they retire, and when they were in Milwaukee, they still come and see me.
Oh! That's good effort. Close but no cigar.
Good effort. You know all these guys like family. Marcy's the greatest person in the world and a great cook.
The beer tastes great every time you come here, that's for sure.
Right. Carry it.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
From those human pin setters of the early days to the automated scoring and light shows we see in alleys today, bowling has long been a favorite sport in Wisconsin.
And joining us now to talk about how the city of Milwaukee played a key role in bowling's rise to national popularity is Doug Schmidt, author of They Came to Bowl, How Milwaukee Became America's 10-Pin Capital. He's also publisher of the 10-Pin Journal, a monthly periodical that circulates in 45 bowling centers throughout the state. Doug, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, Doug, can you give us a brief history of the sport, bowling? Where did it begin?
Well, it had several incarnations many centuries ago in Europe. There was a British version and a French had a version, but the most popular incarnation was developed by the Germans, and it used to be played at cultural events and things where they actually started betting on it. It started off, it evolved into a game of nine pins. It was bowled along a long plank, and it wasn't until it really reached the United States post-Civil War in the 1860s when the German immigrants settled in the East Coast in New York and brought their cultural activities with them, and of course bowling was a staple of that activity. And one popular report is that the game of nine pins was changed because it was originally configured in like a diamond shape. They started to put rules in place to ban gambling on the game of nine pins, so they added a tenth pin so they didn't have to adhere to the rules. Consequently, it changed into the triangle shape that we've been known to play the game with.
And how did Milwaukee...
The German immigrants, you know, ultimately migrated to Milwaukee, and this became a stronghold. There were, years ago, there were at least 13 Lutheran churches that had bowling centers. And so that Milwaukee was embedded with, because a large part of its culture is German, it carried over into bowling.
Now, I remember growing up in Michigan watching Bowling for Dollars. Was TV a big part of the bowling scene here in Wisconsin back in the 70s and 80s?
Oh, yes. What started with the TV was Bowling with the Champs that started in the 1950s. It was, for a time, it was the longest-running show with an NBC affiliate next to Meet the Press. And that always highlighted the local amateurs that, first it started off with inviting pros into bowl matches and stuff, and then they started bringing in local amateurs, and everybody would sit by their phone hoping to get a call from Billy 60 getting invited to bowl on that show. So Bowling with the Champs was really a calling card for considered very prestigious for local talent to get the chance to bowl on TV. And then by the 70s, it evolved into other spin-offs, too, where you had the bowling game and bowling for dollars and things of that nature.
Sounds like bowling.
And we also had the Pro Tour. Miller High Life was a big influence, too, because they hooked up with the PBA and started sponsoring the Miller High Life Open here in 1966, and that was prominent on the Pro Tour for over 20 years.
So it sounds like bowling hit its peak in 1980. Something like 100,000 Milwaukee residents were registered in bowling leagues. Why did it decline from there?
Yes, it was quite a phenomenal number of residents to be sanctioned bowlers. It gradually, in the 1980s, it was a gradual recession, and this was a national trend that people started getting involved in other activities where they didn't want to commit as much to bowling leagues anymore. The bowling market had just reached its saturation point. And gradually people got involved in doing other things. And today, you know, people are so tied to their social media-type things that they don't have the ambition to want to sit around and just bowl with their friends and enjoy a good afternoon or evening of recreation.
But
Doug, there is a resurgence among high school students.
Can you make the case, Doug, that it's time to bring the game back for people to go out and go out in person and bowl with their friends and family?
Oh, definitely. I always felt the businesses should, to create more camaraderie among their employees, that they should sponsor teams and have them go out after work and sit around and just mingle and enjoy three games of bowling and stuff. It has happened in at the high school level. If people ever showed up on an afternoon after school, the camaraderie of these kids and their parents who come out to support them, they just fill the whole concourse with enthusiasm for the sport. The real trick is keeping kids, when they become young adults, to keep them interested in the game.
Well, we're going to leave it there. It's a fascinating history. Thanks a lot for joining us, Doug.
Well, there's a lot more history to it, but okay.
I'm sure there is. I wish we had more time. That was Doug Schmidt, author of the book They Came to Bowl, How Milwaukee Became America's 10-Pin Capital.
It's been a while since I've gotten out and bowled. I've taken the kids a few times, a couple of birthday parties back in the day. You? Been bowling lately?
Wait, you're saying you bowled at these birthday parties?
Yeah.
For the kids
with,
or for
with
you?
The kids.
With the kids. No, it's been a while, but listening to Doug, I'm definitely want to go again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's a good social outing.
Absolutely.
If you don't get enough sleep, you're not only hurting yourself, you could be hurting your future children. This is one of the revelations in some of the latest research on sleep deprivation.
Gemma Tarlak is with us to talk about that story and more from the world of science. She's senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about science. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, it's always great to be here.
So this was kind of a scary article about sleep. I've had a bit of insomnia lately, and now I'm even more freaked out about it. But it turns out sleep is really, really important for all kinds of reasons.
It is, and I have to tell you, this was just the most depressing story for me to edit because it came in beautifully read and everything, but I'm a lifelong insomniac, and so reading the story about all the horrible things I'm doing to myself because I don't sleep just made me so sad. So, I mean, not sleeping is such a big deal for a big reason, and it's also affecting a huge number of Americans, at least 70 million, who have sleeping disorders of a variety. And basically, sleep is when your brain, let's start there, house cleans and gets rid of all the junk it doesn't need, gets rid of the clutter, kind of organizes your closet, if you want to look at it that way, so that the next time you need something from your closet, it's much easier to access. And if you don't sleep, boom, your brain doesn't ever get around to doing the nice decluttering, and it causes so many problems just with the brain. But outside the brain, oh my gosh. So it puts you at risk for all kinds of things, such as a higher risk of metabolic disorders, higher risk of cardiovascular problems. Even, children who have sleep apnea are at a higher risk of having trouble learning in school. It hits you in all different ways.
One of the most surprising things to me, at least reading about this, is it can actually affect us, I guess, on the genetic level. So problems we pick up from not sleeping can be passed on genetically to our kids?
Yeah, well, it actually does not change the DNA. I want to make that clear.
Okay.
But if you've been following epigenetics, it's a huge, very hot field in science now. And people are realizing that there are all these other changes, kind of, if you think of them as chemical reactions around your DNA, that kind of flip the on-off switch of your individual genes. It's called epigenetics, and some things like DNA methylation, it's a big word, but it basically involves flipping an off switch when it should be on or flipping an on switch when it should be off for that particular gene. And that can really affect susceptibility to a variety of conditions. And they're finding that epigenetic changes can be passed down through, future generations, much the way you pass your genes down. But it's not actually changing the DNA.
Mm.
It's an interesting profile you begin with, too, a radiologist whose life was pretty much falling apart because he discovered he wasn't sleeping well, and it took him a long time to unravel it, but it makes you wonder about how much your present conditions might have to do with sleep.
Absolutely, and Joe Borelli, who is the radiologist that we follow in the story, he was on the top of his game. He had two practices, he was an assistant professor, and everything just kind of fell apart to the point that he was worried he had early onset Alzheimer's. It was, that debilitating to his entire life. Fortunately, he got diagnosed with a slightly less common than apnea disorder called upper airway resistance syndrome. And once he was diagnosed, he was able to really rebuild his life, and he did that through getting a good night's sleep. So it's amazing all the different ways sleep can affect us.
So you've had insomnia yourself. We're talking about when we have sleep problems.
Yeah.
Reading all this stuff makes me stressed out about not sleeping. That's not going to help anybody sleep.
It keeps me up at night.
How are we doing in the world of science and medicine at tackling these sleep problems so people get the sleep they need?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. And part of the equation is, yes, you may have a sleep disorder like apnea, but there's another part of it, too, that, come on, do you check your phone before you go to sleep? Do you even turn your phone off? Are you watching TV late into the night? You know, we're kind of in this 24/7 culture, and so you may just culturally be giving yourself a sleep disorder by, you know, checking your email or what have you in the middle of the night. So that's one area that we can fix without any kind of medication. Think of it as maybe behavior modification instead. But they are making terrific advances. In fact, in our June issue, we're going to have, actually our July issue, we're going to have a great story about a new way of helping us fall asleep.
Well, we're going to move on to a groundbreaking story about human evolution centered on a site called Dmanisi. Now, first of all, where is that site?
Well, Dmanisi is in the mountains of Georgia, and that's not the state of Georgia in the U.S. It's the Republic of Georgia, which is right by Armenia and, you know, Ukraine and Turkey. It's nestled into that spot between the Black and Caspian Seas in Europe.
And some hominid fossils were found there, and you know, people find them here and there around the world. What is special? What's weird about the fossils that were found there?
Well, there's a lot of things that are special and a lot of things that are really weird about these fossils. And, you know, they've been finding them there for more than 20 years, which that in itself is pretty exciting because most of the time hominid sites, they're so scattered and you find maybe a piece of skull here and a femur there, but they're finding multiple fossils. So that in and of itself is really interesting. But the other part of it is they don't know what the fossils belong to, what species, and even more interesting, they can't explain what they're doing there so early in the fossil record. They are in Europe about 1.8 million years ago, which is way earlier than we would expect to find hominid fossils in that area.
And it sounds like scientists are scratching their heads because they expected there to be some sort of evidence of sophisticated tools or some other sort of big advantage that would enable these people to be over there, but there wasn't.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing, the researchers I talked to, they all stress that these folks, as far as we know, in the fossil record, these were the first members of the genus Homo to experience seasonality, to experience not like super cold winters like Wisconsin has, but, you know, they had times when there was no fruit on the tree for them to eat, and they had times when they had to figure out, you know, how to keep warm. And apparently, they got to Georgia and were dealing with winters all without either mastering fire or having advanced stone tools that could help them do things, you know, like make clothing and such. Well, not clothing, but, you know, wear skins better and stuff. And so it's a really interesting question because they're very primitive, both in apparently what they had in terms of technology and the size of their brain case. But from the neck down, they are very, very close to Homo erectus, which is kind of the, you know, a couple steps up our family tree. It's pretty close to modern humans. And, you know, they're here in Georgia, like thousands, hundreds of thousands of years before we would expect to find them. So how did they get there, and what were they doing there? That's what I want to know.
Now, there were other fossils found there, too, as I understand, non-human ones, but things that might eat humans, say.
Yeah, in fact, and you know, when you see photos of the excavation site, it's a little bit larger than like the average American living room, I think, and they found 10,000 bones there. Yeah, from 50 other species. You've got deer and bears and saber-toothed tigers, and my personal favorite, the Panthera gombazogensis. I'm probably saying that wrong, but it is a European jaguar the size of a lion. Okay.
Wow.
Think about that. And then you've got these poor little hominids in the middle of all this with, you know, a couple really basic stone tools. So it's probably no surprise that the hominids were eaten quite a bit. They were prey, but they were also predator. We're finding evidence that they were hunting or at least scavenging and maybe occasionally, you know, hitting a deer with a rock just right and taking it home for dinner. But it's incredible biodiversity at that site, and they think it's because of the location. It's where two rivers meet. It's a really rich area in terms of vegetation and such. And, you know, it was one of the researchers I talked to said it was a good place to die because it was, you know, there was water, there was food, and there was a lot of things to eat or get eaten by.
Now, so before we leave this, what is the next step in trying to figure out what all of these fossil finds mean?
Well, they're still digging, and that is maybe the most tantalizing part of the story because they dug a few test holes last summer, and they're going to go back this summer, but every test hole they dug outside the initial excavation area had additional fossils in it. So this area, we're just beginning to really appreciate the richness in terms of fossils for this area. It's super exciting.
It's going to be a fun one to watch. I wanted to touch on one more feature in this month's magazine, 20 Things We Didn't Know About Dust. What's so cool about dust, Gemma?
Okay, so we think about dust like as proof that we don't clean the house as often as we should, but there are so many amazing things about dust. I'll just give you my absolute favorite. There is a place in the southern Sahara Desert. It's an enormous ancient lake bed. It's called the Bodoli Depression, and it is the greatest single source of dust in the world, and dust from that southern Sahara site blows across the Atlantic Ocean to South America, where the iron and phosphorus it contains actually fertilizes the nutrient-poor soil of the Amazon rainforest. How crazy is that?
Wow.
Wow. So dust really gets around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Including cosmic dust, space dust, it sounds like.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the cool things we mentioned in the story is you, too, can see cosmic dust in the zodiacal light, which is a glow that's visible from Earth that comes from the particles scattering sunlight. And if you look in the western sky, just after sunset, or in the east before dawn, and, you know, sometimes you see that light that looks like a city, maybe just beyond the horizon, that's actually cosmic dust. It's, as our writer very eloquently put it, is the glow of a perpetually dusty universe.
Wow.
Wow. A lot of stuff to know about dust. Well, Gemma, thanks for all the science wisdom today.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
We were speaking with Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the latest science news.
Two Wisconsin congressmen, one Democrat and one Republican, are touring the state together in an effort to heal its partisan divide. We'll hear what they're up to in just a moment. I'll invite you first to join in. What do you think needs to be done to overcome the partisan divide, to restore civility in politics, to encourage compromise, negotiation, getting things done among our elected officials? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Take your calls in a minute. First, Glenn Moberg reports. David Obey and Tom Petri each served more than three decades.
76-year-old Dave Obey, a Democrat, represented northern Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District for 42 years.
Tom and I are from an era where it was not a mortal sin to have a friend across the aisle.
His friend, 74-year-old Tom Petri, a Republican, represented eastern Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District for 35 years.
We didn't decide which one was going to be Oscar or which one was going to be Felix in this thing.
The political odd couple are touring the state with the goal of healing our partisan divide. One of the first stops was Dave Obey's alma mater, UW Marathon County.
It isn't just the politicians who are polarized these days. The country is as well.
Tom Petri notes that as bad as things are now, America has seen worse.
War broke out in the Congress itself, and the people who clubbed each other were each elected by acclamation, which told everyone people don't want accommodation, they want war.
For some in the audience, partisanship is a five-letter word, M-O-N-E-Y.
The elephant in the room is money. And what are we going to do about it?
Here's what Dave Obey did. When the Supreme Court loosened the rules on money, he retired.
After the court decisions came down, I knew that if I wanted to stay in the Congress, I was going to have to spend 50% of every day on the phone dialing for dollars like a telemarketer.
But Petri thinks the answer to big money may be small enough to fit in your pocket. the smartphone.
It's free now on the web. I think it's possible from the grassroots up to influence elections much more than was possible in the past.
The idea resonates with plumbing contractor Milt Pockle.
Mr. Petri especially had hope that it'll work itself out, get things back to the middle, and it'll be a negotiation rather than this is my way or the highway.
UW Marathon County student Sean Igers is less optimistic.
Obi touched on it with who you vote for, and I also think it's money in politics. One administration returns the next, so nothing actually gets done.
And for retired schoolteacher Ruth Rosinski, the answer doesn't lie in smartphones, but in getting young people to put them down and talk to each other.
We need to engage young people and ourselves in conversation, that you need more than one newspaper, that you need more than one channel.
As for Wisconsin's partisan divide, Obi blames gerrymandered legislative districts for the party line passage of Right to Work.
There are so many legislative seats that are so safe that there's no pressure on politicians from those districts to compromise with the other side.
But Petri thinks that for his fellow Wisconsin Republicans, the partisanship may have already peaked.
This may have crested, and we will see a certain amount of bipartisanship as the legislature addresses the governor's budget proposals. I would be quite surprised if there weren't changes in the funding for education.
Both men long for a return to the civil discourse practiced by America's leaders in the years following the Second World War.
The value that they brought to politics was concern about we, not concern about me.
You can have constructive as well as destructive disagreement. Sometimes as you debate and argue and differ, you learn something.
Tom Petri and Dave Obi's tour is also making stops in Marshfield, Rhinelander, Mercer, Ashland, Rice Lake, Cadott, Madison, Milwaukee, and Waukesha. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Well, you heard it there from two of Wisconsin's retired congresspeople. There may be some solutions to the partisan politics in Wisconsin and the country. Those two are out trying to heal the divide and encourage civic participation. Some issues they addressed: big money in politics, districts that aren't competitive, old-fashioned civility. And now we want to know what you think about this.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is there hope for bipartisanship in Wisconsin and a country sharply divided along party lines? What do you think it could take for Republicans and Democrats to work together on legislation? Has Wisconsin moved beyond the tense days of the recalls or not? And what's next? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We have Christine on the line in Eau Claire. Christine, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What do you think?
Well, it's a sad day that the politicians can't get along with each other on behalf of their constituents. That said, they need to focus on the fact that they are public servants. I really think that they have forgotten what that means, to be serving the public and not themselves. And they need to focus on what's really best for Wisconsin, not what's best for someone running for president, but what is good for Wisconsin's people now and for the future.
Great. Thank you for your call, Christine.
We heard from Kim on Facebook. Kim says compromise should be the key word. Until both sides can do that, nothing will change. Kim, thanks for that comment. You can share your thoughts, too, on the Central Time Facebook page. Oh, we've got John on the line now in Grand Rapids. John, hi.
Oh, in answer to your question about whether they can be bipartisan, I think the answer is clearly no. The Republicans just passed and rammed through another bill for Right to Work, all under the guise that it's about freedom of choice and not admitting that it's clearly about what wages employers can get away with paying. You know, it's about power and control. Republicans have the power and the control, and they're going to ram through everything they can while they got it.
John?
And I expect the same thing to happen next time around when the Democrats eventually get control, but it is rare to control all three branches of government at one time.
So you think divided government's the only way to kind of force a compromise?
I don't know how you're going to get divided government right now either, because but you're not going to get that right now because of the way the districts are set up. I mean, you can have one contested race, and then there'll be 20 to one that aren't contested at all because they're all set up in the favor of the Republicans.
John,
they're going to control this for a while to come.
John, thanks a lot for the call. You can join in. We're asking for your thoughts on what can be done, if anything, to bridge the partisan divide in Wisconsin and the country as a whole. Call in now at 800-642-1234. And what will it take to restore civility in politics? Again, at the state level, at the national level. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, and we've got a thread going. You can add your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And some of the issues raised in that news piece we just heard, we heard about people concerned about the money in politics as something that gets in the way of bipartisanship, districts that aren't competitive. And what about civility? Can we go back to civility, or do you see civility as something that is being exercised right now in politics at the state and national level? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Tom in Madison is next. Tom, hi.
Yeah, I think the one thing that will bring civility back is basically voters need to get rid of many of the people who are masquerading as conservatives who are actually have a quite an extremist agenda. We have a U.S. senator right now who just sent a letter to Iran, to the Ayatollah Khomeini. We have a governor that has busted private and public sector unions without campaigning on either issue. We have Dale Schultz, probably one of the most conservative at one time Republicans in the state, basically being ashamed of his party. I don't think until we start getting to the point where we no longer acknowledge Walker, Voss, Fitzgerald as Republican, they are extremists. They're pushing an extremist agenda.
All right, we'll leave it there, Tom, so we can get some more voices in. I appreciate you calling and sharing your thoughts.
We'll go now to David with us in Stoughton. David, hi.
Hi. I believe that we've got a long way to fall before there's any hope of compromise. I almost look at it as, you know, alcoholism, where you've got to really hit the bottom. I don't think we've hit the bottom. I think there's a lot more pain to go through, and I don't think there's any desire to compromise. And so it's going to be a painful situation for some years to come with a lot more loss in Wisconsin. And the bottom line is there's going to be a lot of failures and people turning away from looking at Wisconsin as really a good place to be.
David, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts, taking your calls on civility, the potential for bipartisanship, as former Congressman David Obey and Tom Petri go on a bipartisan barnstorming tour trying to bring civility back.
And we'll go to another caller now. Patrick is next in Concord. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
My comments are basically based on looking back as far as the Ross Perot election when he obtained 20% of the popular vote and what happened in the next election regarding independents after that. The Republicans and the Democrats saw a potential third party incursion. And what I'm trying to say is look back at the cause of why Republicans and Democrats are not getting along. It's not that they're not good people with good intentions, but it's the way they're being driven by their individual parties to do specific things that may be against their constituents. So what I've been noticing is if a politician is leaning too much one way or the other against their party will then, you know, basically ostracize them and run another candidate against them and defund them from the party.
Got it. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate your thoughts, too. Thank you for everyone who called in now. And you can also choose to keep your part of the conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page.